It's really hot in here. Take off all your clothes. I am getting so hot. I'm gonna take my clothes off.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Damn Art Majors. We are here on our 21st episode.
We're old enough to drink!
Shots!
I, of course, am Adam Buckafusco. Joined with me today is, of course, the insatiable Aaron Early.
Insatiable?
Insatiable.
You mean insatiable?
Yes.
I'm incapable of being pleased.
And the impenetrable James Dudders Dudley.
I got this one.
I'm incapable of being penetrated, apparently. I can live with that.
He's not incapable. He'd just be really tough.
I mean, maybe.
I am Helm's Deep. Anyway, so, as we said earlier, this is our 21st episode, so we have something a little special this time around.
Do we?
Yes, we do.
What is that?
We are not drinking beer.
Or water. Or tea or coffee.
No. Some asshole's drinking coffee.
Somebody's drinking coffee. We are mixing it up with a little bit of liqueur.
That's right.
So, Dudders, what you drinking?
I have the lovely Maker's Mark Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. It is handmade, distilled, and aged by Maker's Mark Distillery Incorporated in Star Hill Farm, Loretto, Kentucky. I've actually been there. It's actually pretty neat. You got a really nice setup there.
Nice.
And they give you little free tastes and everything. And they let you, you can wax dip your own.
I heard that, yeah.
Yeah.
That, I mean, as fun as that could possibly be. In my mind, it sounds like a lot of fun. In reality, it's probably not.
You gotta buy the bottle, and then you wax, or you can just wax dip one and just say, oh yeah, I got to wax dip one of the bottle. But generally, people buy the bottle, they wax dip it, and they, you know, take it home with them, obviously.
I am rocking a Jack and Coke on the rocks. The rocks have melted because our recording space is quite warm.
There's a tiny little iceberg still floating in there.
Yeah, I guess so. Oh, yeah, look at that. Anyway, it's actually Cherry Coke, which most bars probably don't have. Maybe some maraschino you could add in there. That'd be really good. Anyway, don't forget to tip your waitress and bartender. Aaron, what do you got?
I'm drinking Fireball Cinnamon Whiskey. And
you pulled the short straw.
I definitely pulled the short straw. But I took a Sarastatute and flat brim wearing SoCal bro drink and mixed it with coffee. And it's actually very good. It's not bad. But unlike Richard and Adam's bottles, there is literally no information on this. It just says Fireball Red Hot Cinnamon Whiskey. And that's it.
That's all you need, man. Yep. What more do you need?
Even the government warning isn't even interesting. Oh, wait. Ignite the Night.
There you go.
That's their phrase.
So, this is actually going to be a continuation of episode 20, where we talked about art and movies. We had a lot more to go on that conversation, and we spent the week coming up with some new things to talk about to add to what we left off with last week, and I will say this is going to be a movie-centric episode. So, buckle in, sit tight. And enjoy the show. Do we have any announcements? Anybody got anything personal they want to get off their chest?
Hey, I did discover one thing. If you are going to get a traffic ticket, get it in Durham County. I was in and out of there in 20 minutes.
Nice.
So you didn't.
I got the moving violation, failure to reduce speed to avoid collision with a vehicle. But the nice thing about that ticket, it's one of those tickets where if your insurance deals with everything, they give you a piece of paper, you bring it to the courthouse, they dismiss all the charges against you.
That's a weird offense. It's a ticket to get.
Yeah, it's very weird. So there's a 30-minute window before 9, before the crowds get really bad, that you can get in there and be first in line. I was one of the first people in line, and it was, I mean, I walk up, hand them a piece of paper, and they're just like, yep.
What a pleasurable experience.
It really was the greatest experience in a courthouse.
Oh, you had it. Never mind.
It's kind of in between. Sorry. Aaron, you got anything?
I hate ticks.
Do you want to go into that? Do you really want to go into that?
I'll make it short. As much as I'm a fan of arachnids, the one arachnid that I don't really care for is ticks. Especially not anymore, because I was bitten by one, and afterward, it was one that I didn't recognize, and afterward, there was like a localization of like where the tick bit me was on my upper ribs on my right side, and I was like, you know, whatever, I just plucked the tick off, made sure the head came with it, you know, rubbed the area with alcohol, which you're supposed to do. And a couple days later, I noticed that the lymph node under my armpit was really swollen. And after that, it was just a slew of like flu-like symptoms and fever, vomiting, nausea, loss of appetite, muscle aches, back pain, confusion. And I was like, what the hell is going on? So I put two and two together and found out that, yeah, that tick was carrying some nasty shit and gave me a tick-borne illness. So I went and got a nice antibiotic, and so far it's worked. But it's nasty stuff. If you find a tick crawling on you, immediately take it off.
And yeah, because you...
I was out of commission for a little while.
You almost could have contracted Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain fever.
I could have if I didn't have the foresight to go and get myself checked out. And, you know, because of where it bit me, because it caused that lymph node to swell up, I assumed that there was some sort of bacterial infection from the tick bite.
Sure.
Because of the proximity. But, yeah, it goes through... So Lyme disease goes through stages. You have the symptoms that I was having, which is like a stage one scenario, where it's a bacterial infection that directly affects your immune system. If you don't get it checked out then or cured by an antibiotic, the symptoms will go away after about a month or so. And then that's what they consider stage two. Stage three is when they come back in full force, you have long-term immune system problems and what they end up diagnosing through blood work and stuff as Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain fever.
Spotted fever.
But there's a ton of different...
You've lost, like, I mean, visible weight. And you don't have much weight to lose. So, like, when we saw you last week, dude, you must have lost, like, 5 to 15 pounds.
I probably did, but it's not just from that scenario. I mean, I maybe didn't eat regularly for, you know, a week, but I've been under a lot of stress, so...
Right. You know what this is?
What?
This is...
Payback?
Aaron's story, in the sense that, you know, Dutters has his lobbing off his fingers story. I have my losing my car story. This is your catastrophe story.
This is a pretty shitty catastrophe story. It's not even it's not even cool. It's not interesting. I don't have a cool scar from it. All I got is...
It's a great weight loss
I did actually do a thumbprint today. I was curious what my thumbprint looks like. It's mm-hmm. pretty janky.
It's got the Harry Potter lightning bolt on it.
It does. It's kind of like this weird little... I don't know what it is. A little blobble.
Blobble?
A blobble. That's the technical term.
A globule?
Something. Something. Yeah. It totally ruined my thumbprint. Mm-hmm. I definitely cannot commit any crimes.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, because it is very recognizable.
Yeah. Moral of the story, or my story, is if you get bit by a tick and you're not feeling too hot afterwards, don't hesitate to go get yourself checked out, especially during the summer.
All right. We all did some homework. We all collectively watched a movie together, and the first
segment...
We didn't watch it together. Okay, we all watched it.
Yes.
For this conversation, we are going to do a damn movie review, of Monument Men, directed, co-written, and starring Mr. George Clooney.
It's Monuments Men.
What did I say?
Monument Men.
Monument Men. Monument.
Skittles, it's the S.
You want me to start this?
That one? No, just leave it in there. It's funny.
Monuments Men. Anyway, I checked it out. It's in your local Redbox. It's $1.25 to rent it for the evening. Aaron, what'd you think?
I was pleasantly surprised by it. To give a very, very brief synopsis, it is based on a true story from World War II when the Nazi occupation of Europe involved a secret movement by not only Hitler and Goebbels and... Goering? Was that the guy that was head of the art collection? No, that's not his name. Shit, I forgot. Anyway, it was a giant collective of high-ranking Nazi officers and political officials that their purpose was to go and steal artwork from as many countries and cities as they could...
Get their Nazi hands on.
And...
It was Colonel Baron Kurt von Baer.
Von Baer?
Von Baer. He was the overseer of the Nazi looting operation in France headquarters at the Jeu de Paume Museum. Then you had Bormann, that's the Reich minister, and some guy named Hitler. I don't know what the hell he did.
Hitler.
And then you also had Dr. Helmut von Hummel.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the personal assistant of Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary and primary conduit for information to and from Berlin in the last days of the Reich. And the, I mean, the list goes on. There's tons of people that were involved.
Yeah, they had different guys in every single city and country.
A majority of Hitler's, I mean, I would probably say half of the letters that Hitler sent out, there was a line or two in there about the confiscation of artworks and property and getting it all back to his Führer Museum in...
I wouldn't even call it confiscation. I'd call it just theft.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it was...
I mean, they were killing people for their art collections, more or less.
Yeah.
And, but their grand scheme, though, was to collect all of these paintings that had historical significance. The whole grand scheme of it was they wanted work that was culturally significant, worth a shitload of money, and they had, you know, an agenda behind it, because Hitler had this grand plan for a giant Führer museum that he would house, you know, possibly millions, or at least hundreds of thousands of works of art that were stolen slash possibly confiscated.
And it was going to be in his hometown of, I cannot remember the name of it right now.
Is it in Austria?
It began with an H.
Yeah.
Homs?
Could be. I think it was in Austria, then.
It's a chapter in one of the... I also a couple months ago, I actually read the book that the movie's based off of.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that with me here for the listeners. I can read books.
But the biggest problem with all of this is that as they went through all of these cities and museums and just ripped the artwork off the walls and secretly stole them via overnight train transport and armed guards and trucks, and they would hide them in... no spoilers, very secret locations, and at the same time they would take work that was too contemporary, they felt it didn't fit the German ideal, it was Jewish in origin, Jewish, Polish, you know, Gypsy, whatever, in origin, anybody that was not of a purified birth.
And the point that the movie was trying to make, you know, Frank Stokes, who was played by George Clooney, of course, he would say, if you take away the achievements of a nation, you take away the nation.
Yeah.
You essentially take away the culture. You wipe them from the history books, the existence. And in some ways, that's what Hitler was trying to do by eradicating the achievements of, you know, countries and empires that came before him. He could start anew and save the pieces that he himself deemed good enough for the German Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but to put further emphasis on what you're saying, I mean, they would go through these museums, and all of the work that they found that didn't fit their agenda, they would throw it out in the street and just burn it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, Clooney's character, Frank Stokes, makes a point about what's more important, a man's life or a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts by saying, you know, these artworks, if it's between you and the artwork, don't lay down your life for them. You know, it's just, as much as we want to save them, they're just objects, it's not worth your life.
Yeah.
And then, it, you know, the movie will then question that ideology throughout the story.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of the cast? I mean, we got some heavy hitters. I remember when the movie hit theaters late last year, I wanted to see it just for the cast.
Mm-hmm.
With knowing nothing about the movie, you had John Goodman, you had Matt Damon.
Bill Murray. George Clooney. My favorite.
Cate Blanchett.
Yeah. Jean Dujardin. Played the French guy. He was my favorite. That guy's the shit.
I mean, my problem is I'm biased because I have read the book. And I personally think this was just an opportunity for Hollywood to throw a bunch of big names into one movie.
Yeah.
And hopefully make some money off of it.
Ocean's 11, World War II.
And my problem with it is it is not very true to what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
First off, the oldest person was only 47. And the entire cast was, like, in their 60s.
Yeah, yeah, they made that, Bill Murray and John Goodman look like they were about 70.
That kind of irritated me a little. Also, I don't think they used any actual names of the people that really were involved.
Oh, really?
George Clooney's character is George... Frank Stokes. Yeah, he's based off of Lieutenant George Stout, who actually was the leader of the Monuments Men. And I'm not sure why they couldn't actually use... I mean, the only thing I can think is it's based on a true story.
And it's got military...
Yeah. You know,
there's probably things they couldn't leak.
I think they're only just now allowing documentation from World War II to be given to the public.
Yeah, I mean, like...
within the last 5 years or so.
Well, like, the woman who they... Rose Valland. Is that what the name they use for...
Cate Blanchett? Cate Blanchett's Claire Simone. Is that not a French name?
Yeah. Rose Valland. I mean, she... Like, if you read... I mean, I will say this... Real quick, good book. If you're into history, take a look at it. It's really informative. Like, I did not realize this went on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure for a lot of people to watch the movie.
It's written by Robert M. Edsel?
Yep, with Brett Witter. I think Brett was, like, the historical kind of... He did a lot of the research and stuff. But, I mean, it is a fascinating book. And it's what's so fascinating to me is in between each chapter, they have printed... letters that were sent out by Hitler himself to his heads of the operation to collect the artwork.
Acquisition.
His acquisition committee. I mean, basically telling, like, orders and everything. And then also there were letters sent home by the actual Monuments Men to their wives. Let me tell you something. We do not write anywhere near as well as these guys used to.
Oh, hell no. Of course, all these guys were, you know, college educated. Some of them were freaking professors. And
I mean, these guys... I mean, well, and that's the thing that's so fat. The way they do have accurate from the movie is the background of these guys is so... And most... A couple of them were 4F. They're too old, so they couldn't enlist.
Yeah.
Or they had a health problem. Or they were committed to something... They were already committed to something in the States that was deemed, you know, they were old enough and they were committed to something in the States. They didn't have to go to war.
Yeah.
So they could stay home. But they were all volunteers for this. I mean, this was a George Stout or George Clooney's character, Stokes, Frank Stokes. He did. He pretty much went around to these people and was like, hey, this is your thing. This is something that you care about. Would you be willing to join up with me? I mean, it's volunteer only.
Right.
And they didn't have any funding. It was, like, the fact that he had to pretty much scrounge for a vehicle. They had nothing going right. for him.
Well, see, and this is, and maybe if I read the book, which I did not, based solely on the movie and the way Americans like to portray Americans in movies, you know, they make it seem as if it wasn't for these seven individuals who... took it upon themselves to band together to protect the art, that it would have been lost to time and lost to the campaign.
The Russians.
That's actually accurate.
And then they said the Russians would come in. And the Russians were taking the art, saying that they were protecting it, but really, they called them trophy hunters or something
Okay, so there was a single line in the movie that explained all of this. In the book, I'm sure they expand upon it a lot more.
They really do, yeah.
But the Russians lost over 20 million people in the war. So... they went through and were taking any of the spoils of war that the Germans were collecting and just keeping it. It was compensation. It was fair compensation because they lost so many fucking people. I mean, might as well take and benefit from what you can for the future.
I guess what I was getting at is like where and if I read the book and, you know, I could probably find this out more, but like the separation between Hollywood and the truth, because let's face it, like, I mean, we always kind of favor
we do have that.
I want to know where the Russians, if so, doing exactly what they were doing. But to what degree did the Americans do that? How many pieces did they keep for their own collection?
They don't really go too much into that because it really is because the people they follow in this book, I mean, they really were interested in preserving these pieces of artwork and getting them back to the museums and stuff. But what is accurate to the movie is it is a small group of guys. Yeah. I think at most there was like 30-something Monuments Men.
Yeah, but the seven
But you do. I mean, it really is. Yeah. It was like the initial seven.
Seven's kind of like the magic number, the Magnificent Seven or whatever.
But I mean, it actually. I mean, like in the opening of the book here, there's actually the main characters, and it lists all the main people that were, and it's a short list. I mean, it's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. Ten people, and one of them is Rose Valen, the French woman who was, basically the bookkeeper for all the works that were stolen out of Paris. And, I mean, it's remarkable what these men were, and this, what these men and the one woman were able to accomplish as far as protecting and returning these artworks.
From a pure movie point of view, take the book and the actual events out of the scenario, would you recommend this movie? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Let me go first.
Yeah, you can go ahead for
I would highly recommend it. It was not only entertaining, it was funny, it was dramatic. My girlfriend Sarah and I were talking about it, and she said a very specific line that I thought described the movie very well. She said it's very non-traditional as a war movie and very non-traditional as an art movie. They don't pander to the art community at all. They don't pander to the war community at all. It's like a nice, comfortable medium between the two, as well as there's a lot of truth in it. There's a lot of Hollywoodness in the movie as well. But it was good. As entertaining as it was also, like, there was a few scenes in the movie where I was, like, almost brought to tears. But it was excellent. I thought it was great.
What did you think? Because you read the book.
I was let down by it because I read the book before I saw the movie. And the problem is you can't go backwards. You know, once you've read the book, you can't unread the book. And
time travel's a bitch,
pretty much. And if I try to separate myself, I can kind of see where you're coming from. But it is so hard for me to watch. It was so done up with Hollywood that I think it really lost a lot of the big contributions were lost.
Yeah.
They dumbed it down a lot.
Sure.
I mean, and you have to do that. You're not going to, I mean, honestly, the amount of stuff that these people do, it would take, you know, a series of 10 episodes, an hour long each, to really get into everything that they did. And you're not going to be able to do that in a Hollywood movie. And I understand you got to get big names to get people interested in a subject like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. I'd recommend it as like a rainy day movie. Like, if you got nothing better to do, sure, sit down and watch it. But I also recommend reading the book. It wasn't a terrible movie, but definitely not a great movie.
I actually enjoyed it more than I thought I would. You know, the acting and the chemistry between some of these actors was spot on. John Goodman's always bringing an A game. Bill Murray brings in a comedic element. I don't know if you picked up on this, and what? I want to know if anybody else kind of got the same vibe. When the scene where Bill Murray has to go to a dentist, did that not remind you of Little Shop of Horrors with Steve Martin when he goes and gets dental work from the crazed dentist in Little Shop of Horrors?
Yeah, kind of.
And I didn't know if that was intentional, if that actually happened, or if it was just kind of like a funny gag to throw it back to Little Shop of Horrors a little bit.
I'm confused all of a sudden, because Steve Martin played a crazy dentist in a movie, didn't he?
Little Shop of Horrors. And his patient was Bill Murray.
Oh, okay.
Who was obsessed with, like, dental pain.
I thought Steve Martin was the patient for a second.
No, yeah. It was the other way around.
They might have been referencing that.
Obviously the book is not written the way a movie's written.
Right, right.
The book's not, there's no real comedic.
I would say, I agree with both of you in the sense that it's definitely a rainy day movie. It's $1.25 at the Redbox, so it's definitely worth watching. It's not overly long, so it's not like a 3-hour investment or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're expecting Saving Private Ryan, this is not it, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and call it, I think, for the first damn movie review. We got two thumbs and up and one possibly down.
I would have to say I'm teetering halfway.
All right, you got 2.5 damn art major approved.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, you can pick up this movie at a Redbox, you know, or I'm sure in a month or two it'll end up on Netflix,
probably.
Which is the home for movies you missed in the theater. But Netflix is going through a huge rebranding right now.
Yep.
They've switched their color schemes.
And they're also fighting tooth and nail with the whole net neutrality thing.
Exactly. So if you want to know more about that, may I refer you back to episode probably 18? Yeah, 18.
So, speaking of Netflix, how's that for a segue?
Yeah, excellent segue.
Yeah, I'm glad that we all had, you know, pretty substantial opinions about the movie. Other movies that we have substantial opinions about are...
Hidden Gems.
Are Hidden Gems, yeah.
I had put on our last thing that we never got to.
That's right.
The Hidden Gems. Late at night, you're on Netflix, you got a couple hours to kill before you pass out for the evening. And you just click on that one random movie that pops up that says, you might like this.
It's like, yeah, I'll watch this till I fall asleep. And then it's 3 o'clock in the morning. You're like, wow, that movie was great.
It was an amazing movie. Why have I never heard of this movie? I guess I'll go first.
Yes,
sir. Yeah. My hidden gem is, it's got this ridiculous cast. I think it's Josh Hartnett and as the lead. Woody Harrelson's in it. Ron Perlman. It's Bunraku.
What?
I haven't seen that yet. Never
and
heard of it.
It was exactly that same, like, midnight, come back from the bar, I'm like, I'm too wired to go to bed, I need something just to pass out, and I press play, and I was just dragged in. I mean, it's a vibrant movie. I mean, it is bright, and it's got a lot of this origami for the set design. It's very kind of that Asian theater background where the sets kind of pop up like origami paper and stuff, and it's not a musical, but it's got a sort of a musical feel through the whole thing. The fighting style is very dramatized with dancing, so it's just a really interesting movie. It's kind of a Western samurai, that sort of seems to be the thing with a lot of movies coming out, right?
So they dance fight. Is this West Side Story with Josh Hartnett and Ron Perlman?
Do they snap when they fight?
There is some in the very opening. I think there is some. I mean, there's no way for me to describe it without it sounding absolutely horrifically goofy. But it is goofy, but it's a well done goofy. It is a really exciting movie. There's a narrator through the whole movie, and his lines, like the things that the narrator say, are just, they're cheesy, but they're just perfect. And it really, I was just drawn into the movie. I absolutely had a blast. I've actually watched it several times since. It is a lot of fun to watch.
I watched a movie, I guess it was a couple months ago. It's called It's a Disaster. It stars David Cross and Julia Stiles. I have no idea how I stumbled on it. I was just kind of flipping around.
David Cross is the bald guy with glasses, right?
Yeah, from Arrested Development.
Huh.
So the premise of the movie is Julia Stiles' friends have a, much like us, have a weekly meetup. They do brunch and whatnot, and all these couples get together. They eat brunch, they have fun, drink their drinks, tell their stories and whatnot. And Julia Stiles is on taking David Cross, who is a guy she just started dating, to this brunch. And while they're at the brunch, there's a little bit of turbulence in the relationships, and then all of a sudden the power goes out and the news breaks out that there has been essentially it was like a nuclear fallout outside of their house, and the world has essentially started to come to an end around them.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to stay in the house as everyone they know and love try to survive this nuclear outbreak outside of the house. I loved this movie. I love this movie because it plays up this metaphor of, like, you know, these relationships kind of disintegrating, how even though it's the end of the world, they're all very self-absorbed, you know, and then just kind of like these personalities having to compete with one another while deal with the fact that, you know, they got to bunker down and they got to, you know, figure out how to, you know, tape off the house from any radiation and whatnot. They got to figure out what their plan is. So I was watching this movie. I was loving all of it. thinking it was hilarious, thinking it was fun, dark. And so I finished it, and I was thinking, man, I really like this movie. I'm not sure why I like this movie. And then it dawned on me, and I don't think either of you guys really remember this, but in school, I had written a script and got two friends to act out in a short that was 3 minutes that I called Disaster Intimate.
And is that the one where the two people
are in the coffee shop and they're breaking up next to the window and outside the world is coming to an end?
Yeah,
and
right.
I went, this is why I love this movie. I made this movie. I made that movie 3 years ago.
Somebody ripped you off.
Yeah, right? So, no, but they did it a lot better than I could ever have.
Yeah, they had a budget.
Especially with a tablecloth green screen. So check it out. It's called It's a Disaster, and it is totally worth the 2 hours.
Hmm.
What'd you find on the Netflix?
On the Netflix, I found a South Korean directed movie. It's mostly South Korean actors as well, called The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. And it's a cowboy fictional cowboy western set in, I want to say it's in China, but it features three different militaries: the Japanese military, the Chinese military, and the Korean military. All three of which simultaneously are after a treasure.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a completely undescribed war that's going on. Like, it's totally fictional. It never happened.
Right.
All of the costuming and weapons and vehicles and even some of the language and characteristics of the characters are all very westernized. Like, they have very obvious American influences, but it takes place in what is a fictional, like, 1940s China, Japan, and Korea. But this movie is approximately 2 to 2.5 hours of just nonstop action and gunfighting. And it is also hilarious at the same time. It is so well shot, so well costumed and equipped. I don't know. I was just shocked by the sheer quality of it. Like,
right.
I've never seen that in a...
The production value of it?
Yeah. There's very little CGI in it. It's all practical effects. Or actual explosions, actual actors doing their own stunts. The
Koreans are good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cast of characters, like, you can recognize them from other movies. There's a couple people, I think, that were from the other Korean movie called The Host. I'm drawing a blank on the other guys. It's been a year or so since I've seen this. But if you like westerns, if you like gunfighting movies, you like a little bit of science fiction, if you're an Indiana Jones fan, I highly recommend this. It was hilarious and exciting at the same time.
Well, it's kind of a loose... I mean, it's very, very loosely based off the idea behind The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, but obviously from the title.
Yeah, but they're all after this treasure that...
the motivating factor.
Yeah.
Check Netflix. There's always some cool thing that you haven't heard of or discovered yet.
And if you discover something,
ooh, let us know.
Share it with us, because we are always looking for something new.
Damn Art Majors is a community, people. Even if you're, a pre-med, even if you never went to college, even if you're a 12-year-old, we're all Damn Art Majors on the inside, and we should share.
Yeah, if there's an obscure film that you found on Netflix that you think is worth other people's attention, absolutely let us know.
Yep. So
we'll watch it, we'll review it, or if we hate it, we'll let you know that we hate it.
Yeah. Or we won't even mention it, and then you know that we hate it so much it's not even worth our time to talk about.
Yes.
With the list of movies available on Netflix, you can find an assortment of classic films, movies that, you know, you won't find in a Redbox, and you won't find even at a Walmart, stuff that's kind of come and gone, and things like, you know, we're talking 60s, 50s.
Serpico, that's a...
You got Alfred Hitchcock films, you got...
Al Pacino?
Al Pacino is Serpico, yeah, that's an interesting one. Once Upon a Time in the West, if you're into the Westerns.
That's a good one.
It's a really good one.
All sorts of movies that, in some ways, if it wasn't for things like Netflix and digital downloads and the preserving a film would have been lost to time. So I kind of wanted to take a moment and just kind of discuss the difference between, like, a movie that is a trendy movie and is culturally relevant for that moment in time, but may not, like, live up to the standards of 20 years from now, 40 years from now, but something like a Hitchcock's The Birds.
Or something that's in still, like, the Criterion Collection.
Right.
Yeah.
And to what degree do we keep film going before we just essentially, you know, Disney vault it? We just kind of call it a day. Like, nobody really wants to watch this, you know. Nobody wants to watch Space Jam in 2065. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know, man. I'm pretty sure that they stuck Space Jam up on the Netflix.
Oh, man. I could
that
go
was
with
a bad example, because it's always a good time for Space Jam.
Try Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and we'll go with
that. No, see, but that, to me, Roger Rabbit can be a movie that stands the test of time, because it was one of the few movies, and actually,
it was the only Disney-Warner
Brothers mashup until Everything Was Awesome in the Lego Movie. The Lego Movie is the second movie where you will see Warner Brothers characters interacting with now Disney-owned characters on the same screen.
But they're not the
the
massively popular Looney Tunes and
Disney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Do you think, you know, things like digital preservation of film is an important thing? Do you think there are certain movies that we really don't need to hold on to?
Howard the Duck.
I liked Howard the Duck when I was a kid.
Oh my God.
We need that one to represent the bottom of the barrel. I absolutely think.
Apparently, Howard the Duck's going to be in the new Guardians of the Galaxy. Some reference to Howard the Duck is somehow going to get in there.
I don't want to see that. I absolutely think digitally archiving films is necessary, because eventually it's going to get to the point where we have a database that we can just tap into and have access to any film in existence.
Right.
We essentially already have that. I mean, if you want to find a movie, you can find it.
Sure.
It'll take more than some people's attention span of 15 minutes, but if you want it bad enough, you can find it. Specifically, I'm thinking about the 1920s film Metropolis. That movie has had so many different adaptations and cuts and different versions of it. The original soundtrack, I believe, was lost at one point. They redid it. Giorgio Moroder redid a soundtrack for it, I think, in the 80s or 90s. They transcribed it to VHS. They transcribed it to DVD. Now it's on Blu-ray. Now it's remastered. Now it's recolored. Now it's, you know, Dolby Digital 500,000.
Now the Ewoks can blink.
They keep redoing it, but there's always a tasteful side to it. Like, there's always, you know, some trueness that's kept. I think that's okay. When it comes to doing shit like what George Lucas did to Star Wars in the 2000s,
right?
Not cool.
And why something like the special edition, why not?
I say it's not cool because they have yet to come out with a quality original version.
Well, here's the thing. With the, and this is rumored, so I can't say for fact, but it is rumored that Disney will be re-releasing the original films on DVD and Blu-ray, because there's money to be had in it, because there's enough people crying out for the original 77 cuts of the film. But, you know, I wanted to pose this question of, you know, does a director have the right to alter a movie once it becomes adopted by the culture? Something like Star Wars, I mean, obviously, is the prime example of that. Yes, George Lucas created it, you know, started that ball rolling, but it was the passion of the fans that kept that movie alive throughout the years. So when he goes back to the original, you know, negatives and changes the movie, how much of that does he have the right to do without the consent of the audience?
Well, I think he's got every right to do it because he owns it. But at the same time, I think it's disrespectful. He has the right to do it, but I think he's being disrespectful to the people that have pretty much carried his movie to the point that it has, to the fame that it has achieved and the longevity that it's achieved. And I think I mean, because I'm definitely, I can't deny, well, no longer does he have the ownership, but I can't, at the time, couldn't deny his ownership over the property. And if he wants to do that in his own time and watch it in his studio, by all means, go ahead.
Well,
but
so,
to sit there and, I think, I mean, to really, it is, if you're going to do something like that and not see that it's just bad. I mean, it's just bad. I find that disrespectful.
This, I believe, is part of actually kind of what we were talking about in an episode or two ago and our sign-off, the next one will be better. If George Lucas is an artist, you know, he feels his work is never complete. So, you know, let's bring Da Vinci back. If Da Vinci came back and saw the Mona Lisa hanging up, and he goes, you know, she was really supposed to have green eyes. And he was like, look, it's my piece. I'm going in, and I'm changing her eyes to green, because it was supposed to be green. I always wanted it to
but
be green.
But it's not, I will make the first one better. It's, I will make the next one better. George Lucas, he didn't make the next one better. He went back, tried to fix the first one, and then he, it's like the guy hasn't tried to make the next one better. He's just tried to make more money.
Yeah, so, there's always the pursuit of money.
Yeah.
There's absolutely always the pursuit of money. But sometimes, sometimes whenever movies are released on DVD, for example, you've got the theatrical version, you've got the special edition, then you've got the extended edition.
The director's cut.
The Redux, Blade Runner. The Redux. Blade
Runner
is a fantastic example. Blade Runner has had so many renditions done of it because the original theatrical version had like a narration aspect to it that made sense to a lot of people. It made it easier for an audience to relate to the movie and understand what was going on. It gave a little bit of backstory. That was done because of the time and the place that the movie came out in. The MPAA, the FCC, whatever corporation had a stranglehold on the movie, wanted to make it shorter, wanted to make it more relatable to the audience, and they essentially neutered it to some extent.
And that is a situation where I understand the artist coming back in and being like, no, we need to fix this. Like, this is not my original, like, this was never my intention.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the producers and the studios, you know, dip their hands into the soup, you know, it changes the flavor of it.
Yeah.
And that causes conflict. But, I mean, in some ways, when you look at, you know, historical art pieces and whatnot, you had the people who would commission the art pieces who would probably have some say in what the artist was painting, sculpting, etc. So even though the artists themselves, like how much creative control they had, is questionable. The same way a studio and a director butt heads. But with that being said, you know, the culture itself absorbs the final product, which is a culmination of artist or director, studio and commissioner or church. And that's the end product. Who's to say that they have the right to change it after the culture has absorbed it into their identity.
Oh, I think Blade Runner though is one of the examples where I think the re-released versions, I'm not sure which one I'm talking about because I can't remember which one I've seen. I've seen, I think, 4 variations on that movie. I think.
Yeah, I've seen at least 4.
And in most cases it has gotten better every time. It's also gotten longer every time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of those where I can see where, and it's all, and most of it, I think, has all been original footage that has been recut and
they've been very careful because that is like a cult fucking classic.
Yeah. And I mean, it is an incredibly,
it's like one of the last practical effects movies.
It is one hell of a movie. And it's one of those movies where every time I've seen it, it's like, okay, like you're working on this masterpiece. Someone came in and grabbed it off your easel before you were done with it.
Yeah.
And showed it to everybody. And you're like, no, it's not. So you go back, grab it, and do more work. And, you know, instead, people keep walking in and they keep taking it from you. So that makes sense. But with something like Star Wars, you finished it. You put it out there. And you said, this is it. People loved it. They absolutely love it. Then you walk out there and snatch it from them after they're like, no, this is perfect. Like, this is idea. Like, I built my life. Like, my life and identity is based off of this.
Right.
And you're going to go and CGI in Jabba the Hutt? What?
I think it's a matter of if it's an obvious pursuit for for money. I mean, with the trilogy shit that's going on right now, every second and third, the sequel and then the third sequel.
Every trilogy?
So so many of them are just obvious reach and grab for money. The Star Wars scenario was an obvious reach and grab for money. It's ethically okay, in my opinion, for a director to re-release a different cut of a movie when it's not, like, you know, cheap. When you're actually getting quality original stuff. Like, another example is movies that get killed, their ratings get killed, and footage gets cut so that it fits into a specific genre so they can fucking make more money initially. The movie Galaxy Quest that has... Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver,
Alan Rickman,
just a wonderful cast.
Sam Rockwell,
hilarious movie. It was a really good sci-fi adventure. Pokes fun at Star Trek and Star Wars as well as the original, like sci-fi genre.
Yeah,
that movie. Sigourney Weaver has come out and said that there is absolutely a rated R version of it out there, and we will never see it because of all the red tape. Behind it. Like 20 years from now, maybe.
Yeah. If anybody wants it 20 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, but it would be great. I would love to see a rated R version of that. Because it was just skirting the line I mean, it would have been perfect to fit with the context of the movie. But, like I said, we may never see it because of Hollywood.
What's nice about things like DVDs and Blu-rays is the added benefit of special features and deleted scenes and alternate endings, so you can kind of get a taste of what the studio wanted versus what the director wanted. To kind of I guess counterpoint the Star Wars thing, I was 10 years old when I saw Star Wars. I saw Star Wars for the first time in theaters. If it wasn't for the special edition, I never probably would have seen Star Wars in theaters, at least. So I got to have that same experience, you know, my father got to have, that my mother got to have, that my stepfather got to have. They got to share that with me. And, you know, I don't have a kid or anything, but, you know, I would like to share that same experience with my own kid, getting to see it blown up in a theater with surround sound and not on a television at home, because it's just not the same impact.
But you don't have to put cheap effects into something to re-release it. You can just... I mean, Star Wars is big enough as a cultural phenomenon that you don't have to have an excuse.
And it definitely doesn't need to be in 3D.
If George Lucas or Disney, if they wanted to show the original Star Wars, maybe clean up the sound, clean up the color, that's it. You know, that's all they need to do.
Don't put Hayden Christensen at the end.
Oh,
the hell?
My gosh. Like, anyway. But what's really funny about that is I actually bought... They had a box set. It's the ones that were
digitally, the DVDs.
Yeah. The DVD, the ones that were digitally updated. But then on the special edition discs, it has the originals on DVD.
Those were a collector's item up until when Disney is going to put out
Those are hard to find. I got it just for the three special edition discs that have the originals that are untouched.
Those were put out, I believe, for only like 3 months, and they were highly sought after because Lucas refused. He said he was going to do it for a short run, only one run of a special edition with the original footage films. But those are hard to find until Disney will re-release something.
But I've got the original footage where you watch A New Hope during the lightsaber battle between Vader and Obi-Wan. The lightsabers actually disappear. Because the angle at which they were holding the steel, they couldn't get the light. So you're watching, and it's like, well, his lightsaber just went
away.
Out. Yeah. That's why he lost. His lightsaber went out.
Yeah, lightsabers don't lower. They just blip away.
But, no, I mean, it kind of annoyed me that they kind of... George Lucas, maybe he wanted more money, but he felt the need that it was necessary for him to add these digital effects that really didn't add anything to the story.
Watching the original movies... You hear Han talk about Jabba, but you don't really know what Jabba is until 6 years later when Jedi comes out. And you probably forgot that one line of dialogue 6 years ago. Yeah. So it kind of ties it together a little bit.
Because you have a DVD version of it in 1981.
Yeah, I mean, but do we need to know what a Rontu is? Do we really need to know how the Jawas get to work?
Do we need to see that stupid frog in the bottom left corner eat that thing and then, and then burp? No. But, okay, so you asked, what does it mean when we ask if a film holds up over time?
Right.
I think...
Because that's a big phrase right now is, does it hold up?
Does it hold up? Yeah, that's a cheap way of saying, is the interest still there? I think it's necessary for much, much older films, films that are decades old, especially when you're going back to, like, the 50s and 40s and 30s and 20s. Renewed interest, re-releases, remastered versions, specialty film theaters that host like old movie Thursdays and all that.
Yeah.
They are necessary for keeping a film holding up over time.
Right.
Also, I think Hollywood is. I mean, they released that really bad Wolfman with...
I mean,
it's not terrible.
Benicio del Toro.
Benicio del Toro and Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
But because they released that, that gave Universal an excuse to basically re-release...
My only problem with that movie is in no way, shape, or form do you think Benicio del Toro is the offspring of Anthony Hopkins.
Well, anyway. Sorry. But when that movie came out, they re-released the original Universal monster flicks on DVD in these special packaging with, you know, Bela Lugosi's Dracula and Lon Chaney Jr.'s Wolfman, all those movies, which gave me an opportunity to go grab them up. I think that's what's that's what's nice is when Hollywood does, they do some goofy remake or something, but it gives people the opportunity to go back and watch the source material.
Right.
Pretty much. And I think that is important. And, you know, then they'll make their buck at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
With Godzilla, I don't know how I bet so many people went on to Amazon Prime and watched the original Gojira.
Yeah.
And
it was on, like, Netflix and Crackle.
Yeah, I mean, it was everywhere.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's an awesome movie to watch. And... what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, these new movies come out for a new generation, and then these kids are like, wait a minute, so this is based off of there's another movie out there? So these young, they go back, and then they, you know, they're on the internet all the time, so what do? They said they do some research, and they realize, oh, this is like the first movie that this sort of practical effect was done.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. And they have more respect for that movie, because, you know, our generation, we're not going to sit there, or the newer generation, they're not going to realize that it started out as something else, unless these newer movies come out, because they're not going to take the time to go back and be like, what was
so
an
you're
incredible
saying
1950s movie?
Reboots and reimaginings actually help preserve film for a new generation.
Yeah.
I think they do. Like, parodies help the source material. I mean, if you parody something, like, comedically, people are going to go back and find out what it's based off of.
Like
the same
Mafia and The Godfather.
Yeah, I mean, just you have people doing, like the guy that puts his orange cat into famous paintings. That he, like, a fat cat will make this painting look better.
Yeah, I've seen that.
So then what do people do? They're like, well, what the hell does the original look like? And they go back and next thing you know, they've spent 35 minutes researching some older painting prior to there being a fat cat in it.
Or 5 seconds, but they remember.
It has the parody, the reimagining, the reboot, whatever, has helped to preserve the original. And
well,
I think that's an important thing.
It is important. Rebooting is very important to preserving the past. With that being said, we're going to reboot this old but fun game, Damagories. We have a special Damagories today, guys. It is a movie-inspired Damagories. Everybody remember Damagories? If you don't, go back a couple episodes, listen to a Damagories. It's a lot of fun. So
actually, this is Damnergoies.
Yeah, I misspelled it on that one. I made up the word. I can misspell the word. It's a reimagining of how you spell Damagories.
You could have at least misspelled it phonetically so it was pronounced the same way.
So, Damagories is a game where we have 6 categories. We choose a lettered die, whatever the die lands on. We have to fill in answers for those categories. You get a point for alliteration. So answers that have words that start with the letter multiple times. So like mystifying Misty's muffins would be a 3-point word. Anyway, so without further ado, let's go down. Dunners, what are the topics? What are the categories for this?
Our categories are, number one, a failed Spielberg movie. Number two, a porn parody. Number three, a bad date movie or a rom-com. Number four, a Michael Bay explosion film. Number five, a doomed to failed reboot.
I like this, Damagories.
Reboot trilogy.
Or reboot,
trilogy!
Reboot trilogy. And, oh, I didn't know it was also trilogy. But anyway. And then number six, a Rob Schneider film. So
the next Rob Schneider film. So we're going to roll the die. We're going to put 1 minute on the clock to write our answers. As always, we encourage you guys, the listeners, to submit your own answers via the Facebook, the Twitter, the Podomatic, and now even the DamnArtMajors.com. The Gmail, DamnArtMajors@gmail. Send us your answers. We want to know them, and we will shout them out. So here we go. We're going to roll the die. Looks like the letter I. Why do we keep getting vowels? What's going on here?
Because our life, we like to make our life difficult.
Yep.
Anyway. So, minute on the clock, buzzer starts now.
Hey, we're back. Man, that was close. You got that last one in. Like,
just in the nick of time. Wow, I'm not even sure I can read my own handwriting right now. So damn quick. Yes. All right. So, first category is failed Spielberg movie. Adam, what'd you get?
Inseminating Private Ryan.
That's not your porn parody?
Surprisingly, no. No, it is not.
All right.
Oh, my God.
Aaron?
I got Indiana Jones and how he survived in the Frigidaire.
Nice.
Which, for those that don't know what a Frigidaire is, it's a refrigerator.
Yeah. I have also Indiana Jones and the Intrepid Space Flight.
That would be fucking terrible.
You just wanted to work another I in there.
Hell so yeah, I did. Points. Yep.
I see what you did there. All right, number two, a porn parody. Aaron.
Indiana Bones.
I have Invasion of the Booty Snatchers.
I have Ice-Aged Cougars.
Oh, nice.
That sounds nice. Disgusting. Hey, number three, love. Date movie / rom-com.
This one's hard.
I have Adam Sandler in I Wanna Love You featuring Tyler Perry as every woman.
I don't really like my answer, especially after your previous answer, but I got Invasion of the Panty Snatchers.
who's that one featuring? Is that Will Ferrell and Andy Samberg?
Nope, Daniel Craig.
Oh, very nice.
Nice.
Very
nice. I don't think my rom-com counts because I forgot this guy was knighted, but it was Ian McKellen's Lovers. It would actually be a very successful movie, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. It really is just actually X-Men 3, and yeah. It's all the shots between Magneto and Pyro.
It'd actually be Sir Ian McKellen's Lovers.
Yeah, it counts.
Number four, Michael Bay's Next Explosion.
Adam. Movie.
Oh, Next Explosion movie. Adam.
The Island 2. It's really The Island 1 all over again, but nobody saw it, so this time maybe we'll see it.
I just... The title of mine is just Italy.
Blows up Italy?
I like it. Mine is taking the most boring subject Internal Revenue Service.
Tax. Go to theaters this tax season.
He'll find a way to blow something up.
Jesus.
All right, doomed to fail reboots. Dutters, what do you got?
I didn't realize it was supposed to be.
Whatever.
I have The Incredibles, Married with Children.
Oh, that would actually be fun to watch. I have The Iron Giant starring Woody Allen as the Iron Giant.
Jesus, that would be fucking horrible.
What's the idea?
The giant just stuttering the entire time.
Yeah, and trying to creep on his niece. I have I Love Lucy.
Starring Will Ferrell and Nicole Kidman.
No, I would want to see
Eddie Murphy,
I don't know who
my everyone.
Okay, who would we want to see play Lucy and Desi Arnaz or Ricky Ricardo?
Tyler Perry as both roles.
Shut the fuck up.
No. Lucy.
God, who would play? Amy Poehler. Tina Fey. No, she's too classy. Oh, maybe. I could see Amy Poehler and Tina Fey playing Lucy and Ethel.
Yeah. Ricky, though, probably go to someone like Will Arnett or...
Well, he's got to be Hispanic. Benicio del Toro.
He was Cuban.
Antonio Banderas.
He's too old.
Yeah.
Who would play Little Ricky?
Little Ricky?
Dutters.
Fez.
Oh, man. Oh, no, it'd be that guy from... No, he's too old now, too. Anyway, whatever. Doesn't matter.
All right, last one. The next Rob Schneider movie.
The Inanimate Object.
Nice.
Mine is The Internet. A Man's Journey to Find Himself. A Series of Tubes.
Oh,
Rob Schneider is The Internet.
Yeah.
Rob Schneider is the ignorable friend of Adam Sandler.
Ouch.
Ooh.
That guy's gonna commit suicide.
That dude needs to restart his career.
I really want to know what happened to him.
I don't know. We left him back in the early 2000s with The Animal, The Hot Chick, The Deuce Bigelow, The Male Gigolo.
Deuce Bigelow was actually pretty damn funny.
And then it was Deuce Wasn't Bigelow, there a European sequel to that? Gigolo.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then...
That's a huge bitch!
Oh, let us never.
You're right. They do all have those in front of them.
Yeah.
Huh.
Did you say steak?
Well, that wraps up part two and, you know, two of the Damn Art Majors movie spectacular, if you will.
Thanks for viewing with us.
Yeah, we will definitely probably do another movie episode later on. I don't know. Eventually.
Yeah. So put away your popcorn until next time, folks. Hopefully, the next one.
I really want to see what the next one would be like. Never mind.
But I'm sure the next one will be better.
Fucking better be.
I don't know. We'll find out.
Rob Schneider is...
The next one!
Will be better.